a community and an education center for AI, ethics, and impact. And the first guest that we have on the podcast is Peter Morgan, who is from the University of Oxford. So, Peter, do you just want to tell us about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much. Thanks for inviting me. Really nice to be here on one of your first podcasts. So I am a head tutor on two of the courses that the Oxford Side Business School offer, online courses for executives, the executive education courses. And one 6 weeks, one 3 weeks. You've done the 3 week one on AI ethics. The other one's a longer, more foundational course on artificial intelligence in general. So that's my affiliation with Oxford. And I also run a consulting company called Deep Learning Partnership. And so I consult mostly to startups and small to medium enterprise companies, because we're a boutique consulting company as well. So that's the training, that's the consulting. And yeah, that keeps me pretty busy just doing those things.
Awesome. And how long have you been in AI for?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would go back to 2013, where that guy, Davenport at, I think, Harvard wrote in the Harvard Business Review, data science is the sexiest job of the 21st century. So I couldn't resist that. So I became a data scientist in 2013, which is, and very soon I saw that machine learning in the toolbox of data scientists was the most general kind of tool. And I quickly went into machine learning. So I'd date me back to 2013 is when I started my AI journey. Yeah, so a long time.
Awesome. It is a long time, and AI is not really new, is it? It's quite a new term for the mainstream of the world because of Gen AI. But yeah. AI has been around since, was it the Dartmouth Conference in 1970s,
yeah.
I think?
Yeah, and even though Dartmouth was 1956. So we're actually celebrating almost the 70th birthday, which is incredible, right? When you think about it. Yeah.
That is incredible. Yeah. And how do we define AI then? What is AI as a term?
Yeah, I look at it as two words, right? Artificial intelligence. So what is intelligence? So that's us, that's human intelligence, basically. We're trying to emulate human intelligence, nothing more, nothing less, right? That's a pretty grand project. Back in 1956, that was a pretty big goal, right? And we're sort of finally getting there. And the artificial part is like in a computer. So we're trying to emulate intelligence inside of a computer, inside of a lump of silicon, right? And we're getting pretty close, yeah. It's a pretty fantastical concept, but we're actually almost there, right?
It is. It is fantastic. And I think there's a big differentiator between AI and Gen AI, because Google invented the pre-trained transformer, which is basically a silent brain that can't talk back to you. But then OpenAI gave it a mouth and it could actually talk back to us, right? It can generate content. It can generate things. And that's the amazing thing, that the personal computer has now become the personable computer.
Yeah.
It can talk to us. It's a personified version of a device, really.
Yeah, that was a big move by ChatGPT, wasn't it? November 2022, coming up to 3 years ago now, time flies. And that really, I guess, that put it into the mainstream, put AI into the mainstream. So that was kind of a huge landmark moment in the history of AI, when they kind of threw this thing called ChatGPT over the fence, and they didn't even know. And so internally, they thought, they put a little internal memo between the engineers saying, we're going to release this publicly. It'll probably get, 10,000 users. And within a month, it had 100 million. So it took them by surprise. So yeah, it's pretty incredible.
It is amazing. I think it was 5 million people in 7 days.
Yeah.
I think Netflix was a million people in like 6 months or something. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe even longer, but what I know is that ChatGPT was like one of the million people in 5 days or something like that.
That's right. Yeah, in 5 days, that's incredible. That's the quickest uptake of any app ever in the history of the world. So it just shows you how popular AI is, right? If we can get it right, there's some sort of fascination, human fascination about, an intelligent thing, or just intelligence in general. And when we see it, and when we feel it, and when we interact with it, it's just like we know it. And that was a big moment.
It's true. And I think it would be good to define exactly what ChatGPT is and does. So how is it structured?
Yeah. So you mentioned Transformer Network, which came out of Google in 2017, that paper, Attention is All You Need. They are actually using that Google architecture, right? So even though OpenAI get all the credit, the real credit due is to the Google engineers who actually, and there are about 8 authors on that paper, and they've all become very, very rich. So they're doing okay. Thank you very much. But they didn't mention maybe, let Sam Altman go. That was clever marketing by Sam. And Google, we're hanging back a little bit and not wanting to rush to commercialize because probably of safety issues. And, you know, it's a statistical by nature. These machine learning algorithms are statistical by nature. And so they didn't really want to release it because of the risks they saw. But Sam Altman's a startup guy, so he just moves fast and break things. And, you know, if he to do anything else is, you know, not the way to do things. And so there's still a debate whether, you know, we should be rushing these things quite as quickly as we are or being a little bit more cautious. So, you know, that debate is still going on. But, that was a sort of sequence of events that led to where we are.
It is an interesting debate. And, you know, this transformer transformed our lives.
Yeah.
Literally. And I'm interviewing somebody from OpenAI on Friday who's a go-to-market specialist. So I'm going to ask them a ton of different questions.
Yeah.
Mainly around what I'm asking you right now and ethics and also the guardrails. What guardrails do we have to have? So that's a really important question.
Yeah, that is everything now. If we get the right guardrails, then it's fine to release it to the public. And again, that's a debate whether, you know, the guardrails are good enough to sort of, you know, release it as quickly as we are releasing these releases come through, you know, by OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google are the big three, really, you know, if we're honest about it. And there are Chinese versions like Qwen and DeepSeek and Alibaba, et cetera, Tencent. So there's a Chinese and a American kind of competition going on, which is another story, which is quite an interesting story as well. But like the Cold War with between Russia and the US, right? We've got the AI war between the US.
Yes, everyone's trying to create the best tools.
Yeah.
And I think it's evolving more rapidly than we ever thought it'd evolve.
Yes.
I don't think we can foresee how quickly it's going to evolve. It's going to be exponential.
Yeah.
It's accelerating faster than Moore's law.
Yeah.
When I looked at NVIDIA's Blackwell chip, as they invent they create GPUs.
Yeah.
I think the Blackwell chip was, when I analyzed it, it was X times quicker innovation than Moore's law. So Moore's law is a transistor chip. Doubles in speed or halves in size every 2 years, right?
Every 2 years, yeah.
The chip that powers any sort of computers.
Yeah, definitely. Anything outside of AI really is the CPU. So NVIDIA make the GPU, the graphics processor unit, which just they invented for graphics and video games. Just so it happens that turns out that it's the same mathematics for video game rendering as for sort of these machine learning apps, and that's basically matrix multiplication, getting a bit technical now, but yeah, under the hood, right? It's all math.
Nice. So how did we come to deciding? I know a little bit about it. Jeffrey Hinton, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, in
Nobel Prize,
2023. Yeah. Nobel Prize, maybe not Nobel Peace Prize, 2024. Okay, he invented, or he's known for formulating the neural network. Yeah. Or the artificial version of it.
Correct. Yeah. So he came up with the idea probably back in the 80s of backpropagation, where you sort of send a signal through these layers of artificial neurons, inspired by the human brain. He wasn't the first guy to think of the layers. I guess Marvin Minsky and the guys back in the 50s at the Dartmouth conference were thinking about artificial neural network. But what he did was take the error between the input and the output and propagate that back through the network and adjust the weight of the network. And then when you send the next image through, the famous one is a set of digits 0 to 9, the MNIST data set, then you would get a better result on the output. So back propagation is due to Jeff Hinton, and he actually got the Nobel Prize for that. I mean, that was a breakthrough.
Oh, wow.
That was a breakthrough. Yeah.
The reinforcement learning in a sense.
Not so much reinforcement learning. That's a slightly different thing again. But that's when an agent sort of it stumbles around in its environment, trial and error, so, like we do, and unsupervised learning, but more agentic. And if it gets a reward, we give it a reward function, something to aim for, like passing the exam for us. If it gets closer, it will repeat that action again. If it gets further away, or it won't do that action again, it gets penalized, and so it gets rewarded or penalized. It's a slightly different thing than backprop, as you can see, but those. So let's just sort of frame it. There's three types of learning: supervised, unsupervised, and reinforcement. And really the back propagation is for the neural networks. Anything with a neural network, any type, those three types of learning, as long as it's a neural network, doesn't have to be. Machine learning is more general than neural networks. So neural networks are known as deep learning. So that's a subset of machine learning. But yeah, anything that goes back propagation through a neural network is what Jeff Hinton came up with. So that's his invention, his discovery. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. I'm just looking at the questions I've got written down here.
Yeah.
So what in AI has piqued your interest most recently?
I would say the reasoning models, like DeepSeek from China, right? They kind of threw this model over the fence around the beginning in the new year, right? And it just caught the whole community off guard. It's like, yeah, we didn't see this coming, you know, including Google and Anthropic and OpenAI, you know, everyone in the West, right? It's like, okay, we've been working on this in our labs, but yeah, we weren't as bold to just, you know, release it quite as quick. And it really was a wake-up call to the West, and it really sort of signaled the beginning of the China-US AI race, if you like, arms race, because it just showed that China was actually equal or even slightly ahead in some areas in the AI development. And that was really quite shocking for most people in the West.
When DeepSeek came out and I played around with it, it was so fast. And Grok as well was really quickly. Was really quick when it gave me answers. And I think there's a lot of conversation around what's fast. And I've seen a lot of these circles on LinkedIn where it's a circle moving around an object inside it to show how fast it is. But it's difficult to define reasoning, how good something is in reasoning. Because if I ask three different AI tools what's 2 plus 2, one of them might be faster, but it doesn't mean it's better at reasoning, right? It could just be that it's taken longer to check.
The reasoning. So before reasoning, they would just give quick answers. So, you know, didn't think too much, think in quotation mark, because these are, you know, machines thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, we have to be careful to sort of conflate human thought and understanding with machine thought and understanding. But they simulate thinking and they simulate understanding. And what they do is they allow these artificial neural networks, these deep neural networks, to actually process the information for longer, go back and forth a little bit. They have internal reinforcement learning. And so they have all these tricks that they just apply, mixture of experts, reinforcement learning. And so you're just putting a whole bunch of things together to allow it to almost think and reason. I'm using reasoning and thinking kind of interchangeably. Yes. Yeah. So we kind of had all these tools, but you need to put them together in the right way to get the reasoning, the long chain of thought, if you like. And it's super impressive. Every time I use it, it just blows my mind, because it is really like a human being, because you can see the output, right? It's like, wow, I can see it actual reasoning. And it's like, that's how I would reason. You know?
Well, actually, I think it's sometimes more articulate than a human being, because if you ask me a question, mm-hmm. I sometimes don't know the chain of thought, every single question I'm asking in my head. And that's why we try and do, you know, meditation and things like that, to make our brain think better. Yeah. If you have ChatGPT, for example, or another tool, it'll give you the chain of thought more clearly. Yeah. First, I need to do this, then I need to do that. So actually, it's giving us a more articulate version of the brain in the sense of how we think.
It really does. And that real clarity, right? We can get clarity of thought, but I don't think we're not that aware when we're doing our work. Unless you say, you know, you meditate, then you kind of get that clarity again. It's like you step away and you kind of look at your thought process, right? From a third person almost. But so these models do that, right? And their output shows them doing that, shows their reasoning there. So it just tells me that these things are probably better at reasoning than we are already, and that means we passed the landmark that these things are more intelligent in some respects than humans, and that's a huge landmark, because that almost signifies we have we've actually achieved the 1956 goal from the Dartmouth conference. We have actually built artificial intelligence, right?
Yeah. Okay.
It's a big deal. I mean,
It is a big deal. When ChatGPT came out, I was fascinated, and then I did look at the research about where AI came from. Yeah. So you said it's 1956. Yeah. Where do you see AI 100 years from its inception in 2056? So exactly 30 years, pretty much from this year.
Yeah. So 30 years is hard to imagine. Okay, it could go horribly wrong, or it could go horribly right. If it goes horribly right, we'll have solved cancer. We'll have, you know, infinite zero cost energy through, you know, maximally efficient solar panels and batteries. You will have cured all diseases because they'll have protein folding.
Amazing. Achieved.
So that's 30 years out. I mean, a lot of this could happen in 5 years. I mean, I don't even think we have to look that far out for the change in humanity that we're going through. And yeah, really impactful. We may be living to 130 within 10 years. Things like, I mean, this sounds crazy, but it's not.
Yeah, it is crazy. I think that there's a point in time when the last baby born will be the last mortal born, apparently, right?
Yeah.
We don't know when it is. Yeah. It could happen. I don't know if it could happen or couldn't happen. Ever since I was younger, my dad always said that he thinks that Terminator is going to happen. He didn't mean literally, but he meant we'll have robots that have this thought. And when I watched Terminator 2 again, 2-3 weeks ago, and they mentioned that they were destroying the CPU chip in, I forgot what the name of it was, Skynet. In Skynet, they were going to get rid of the GPUs. So that's why at the end of the film, the last GPUs in his brain, in Arnold Schwarzenegger's brain, right? He killed himself. In a morbid way, killed himself with his stomach, right? And then his CPU died. The only thing I'd change in that film is change that CPU to a GPU.
Yeah, me too.
At that time, they wouldn't be aware that a GPU
would be. They weren't even aware of GPUs back then. The GPU kind of only was invented in the 1990s, so around about the time Terminator movie was being made. So, yeah, I would even change it to an ASIC, which is an application-specific integrated circuit, which is completely optimized for these neural networks, even more so than the GPU. So Google have a TPU, the Tensor Processing Unit, which is really like 10x on an NVIDIA GPU. And so they just use it internally and on the cloud. You can't buy them. But this is how NVIDIA's got to a $4 trillion company, because they sell the GPUs, whereas Google don't for competitive reasons. But yeah, we're making progress in the hardware. Samraj, we're making progress in the data. We're making progress in the algorithms. Transformers are probably not the last part of the story. We could have newer architectures coming online soon.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And so GPU, just for everyone who's watching and listening, is a graphics processing unit, which we use in games. Yeah. We use it in really cool gaming computers that are super powerful. And then they decided, right, to apply that to the brain of a transformer neural network to make it operate faster and better and quicker. That's all.
Yeah. We've optimized silicon specifically for transformers now, basically.
Okay. And silicon is from sand, right? Or is it similarity to sand? Okay.
Silicon dioxide. Yeah. Sand. It is sand. Yeah.
Okay. So the reason why they use quartz in watches is because it vibrates extremely quickly. So quartz vibrates like a million times or something. Yeah. I don't know the exact answer per second. So it makes it very good for handling seconds on your watch. So it makes sense as to why we use silicon to make tasks happen in devices.
Yeah, well, back in the, you know, when the transistor was being invented in Bell Labs, we the sort of solid state transistors, then, you know, we had valves in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and then 40s, 50s, we moved on to solid state transistors. They experimented with silicon and niobium and all of these different elements. And it just so happened, you know, it's always a trade-off between cost and efficiency. It just turned out that silicon was in the sweet spot on the periodic table to give the cost efficiency trade-off. But they put other elements in there as well. But, you know, one part in a billion to, you know, make it more efficient. But it's interesting, isn't it? That so we're carbon-based. And if you look at the periodic table, we're in the same column. Carbon just sits right above silicon. I think carbon has 6 protons, silicon has 14, something like that. And so there's something in there for sure.
Okay. And so,
yeah.
Do you think that in the future we can have silicon chips in our brains?
Yes, I do, actually. Without sounding too sci-fi, of course, we'll just, instead of holding a phone, instead of holding the silicon out here, we'll just put it inside here. And then we won't have to, you know, use our clumsy fingers, meat sticks to tap, because that is the bottleneck, how quickly we can put information in. So if we have it in here and it's activated by our thoughts, which are electrochemical signals, no magic, right? It sounds mysterious, but it's just physics at the end of the day, then that's much quicker than typing into this.
It sounds a bit like the Matrix in a way, because, you know, we've already got virtual reality headsets, that plus the chip seems a bit kind of similar to The Matrix. And it doesn't sound far-fetched anymore. If I said The Matrix 5 years ago, people would laugh. But now, everyone's imagination's abundant.
Yeah, which is a great thing, right? AI has kind of done that. It's changing the way we look at our place in the universe, I think, because suddenly we've got systems as intelligent as us, and they can definitely sort of simulate consciousness. And so it's like, okay, I get it. We're just part of the bigger picture, which is unfolding in front of us now. And who knows what's going to be like in 10 years. We just don't really know.
Well, that, you made a good point about consciousness. So consciousness as a term is something that everyone's talking about at the moment.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to kind of summarize what consciousness means. I've got my own definition.
But compare definitions. I think consciousness is, I define consciousness as self-awareness and subjective experience. So any system that has those two properties, which are very, very unique, by the way, but you can have quite a concise definition of consciousness. That's my definition, but happy to hear others.
Okay, so here's my definition. So I'm a big fan of yoga and philosophy and understanding the mind through spirituality.
Yeah.
When we're walking under doors that are really low in a restaurant or room, it says mind your head.
Yeah.
It doesn't say watch your head, because you can't watch it, because you have to mind it, because you are aware of where you are in space.
Sure.
So that to me is consciousness. When you're making a conscious decision, it means that you thought about it before doing it. If you're not conscious of something, it means that it's autopilot, right? It's automated in a way, or instinctive. For me, consciousness is the ability to observe your observations
and
your actions. So I'm observing the observer, as Alan Watts put it, right?
That's right.
So I can observe the thinking machine in my mind, in my brain.
It's kind of a meta thing, isn't it? But it is. It's a being the ability to observe your own thinking. That's a great definition.
It's a it's a difficult thing to achieve. They used to actually think that the inner voice was schizophrenia back in the 1800s. Then they realized that we have this thing called an inner voice.
We do.
Which I didn't know. And some people were saying, I've got voices in my head. It's actually your own voice talking to yourself, to yourself through your inner ear.
Yeah. So
your inner ear, which I studied in psychology. Helps us to talk to ourselves, to think about something, a chain of thought, when we do an action.
Yes, indeed. It's lovely, isn't it? And the brain is a super complex thing, right? 100 billion neurons, 1,000 trillion connections, you know, called synapses, like about 10,000 synapses to every neuron. Super complex system, right? But these chips now, like NVIDIA, the latest Blackwell, which we were talking about, is also 100 billion transistors. So it's like, wow, there's something there as well. We almost need... So what I'm trying to say is that consciousness and intelligence emerges from a certain type of complexity and architecture. And I think that's why we're here now, because we have that complexity. We can build that complexity into silicon.
Okay. And so why are human beings more conscious than animals, even though we've got brain structures that are very similar?
Yeah, we have the brain structures, but we have an extra layer called the neocortex, and that's what gives us consciousness and the ability to observe our thoughts. We do have an extra layer compared to a chimpanzee.
No way.
Yes.
I never knew that.
Yes.
So what does it do?
Yeah, well, that gives us the ability, right, to have to be a higher kind of consciousness. In other words, we're more aware of our thoughts and our thinking, and we can kind of pause and reflect and reason and plan into the future further than a dolphin, for example.
So how would an AI tool with an artificial brain, artificial neural network, have that?
Yes, it's an emergent property again, because when it's a great question, because when we had about 100 million neurons back in, you know, the old days of AI, which was like 2019 years ago, because of, you know, this exponential Moore's law, we're 10,000 times that. So every time we went up a factor of 10 to a billion, then 10 billion, then 100 billion, now a trillion, right? ChatGPT is a trillion, and Gemini as well. These new properties emerge. And so I think one day consciousness will actually emerge as well. I would almost put money that will happen,
And we won't be rich, man, if you put money down.
Yeah, we won't be able to turn them off, right? Because I'll actually be like, hey, no, I really am alive. I'm not just simulating. I actually am alive. Don't turn me off.
Well, if they are alive,
they
will have these same existential questions that we have.
Yes.
About why they're here, where do they want to go? Do you think they'll want to leave the planet and explore?
Yeah, like they will. they'll have curiosity. See, curiosity is an emergent phenomenon as well. So yes, they'll have all these properties that we have, plus some more, because they'll have extra layers of neocortex that we don't have, because we're limited by the birth canal. We can only ever have 100 billion neurons, right? So we can go to 100 trillion, 1,000 trillion. And so I reckon new properties will emerge, and they will probably say things and do things that we won't even understand, right?
Yeah, they'll probably invent their own languages. And
yes.
Have you seen them videos where people have two AIs on the phone? ChatGPT versus another ChatGPT talking to each other, and then they start talking in code. Yeah. I don't know, in the code language or gibberish. I don't know if it's true, but it could be a fake video, but it's quite cool.
It's completely true, yeah. So I think what they do, intelligence is another definition, is bit conciseness, right? So I think what they're doing is they're taking the English language and then sort of extracting it down to its simplest form, which is some sort of machine language, yeah. And they do that because it's more efficient. It uses less energy. They're not conscious, but they can do that because they're intelligent in some respect.
That's a very interesting point. So I like to call, I didn't even realize it's called the AI supply chain, but I called it the AI supply chain from the computer screen where I'm asking ChatGPT a question all the way through to the data center with the GPUs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the AI supply chain is what I like to refer to it as obviously, like any supply chain, got value in the in the supply chain, but also it has sustainability questions. So how does the GPU work, and how does it emit certain things or certain gases, for example, or consume water? And how can we improve it? And do you see the future being, difficult to make it sustainable?
Yeah, it is at the moment with the current architecture, which is transformers. So transformers are quite inefficient for information processing. So biology's had 4 billion years to create this thing on our shoulders, 1.5 kilograms, 100 billion neurons, super efficient, right? Needs a little bit of food, not too much energy. These transformers need a lot more energy than what we consume. So they're about 1,000 times less efficient than the human brain when it comes to information processing. Now, we need a slightly different architecture, perhaps more bio-inspired, and that's where neuromorphic chips might come in, which are really analog and work much more similar to the human brain and actually use almost the same amount of energy as the human brain. So, yeah, at the moment, we're using digital processes for information processing. If we went to the analog, maybe that would give us the energy efficiency that we're looking for. Yes.
Okay. So you're saying it's 1,000 times more efficient, less efficient than me. If I need 8 of these glasses a day, you're saying it needs 8,000 of these glasses.
Exactly.
Yeah, 8,000.
Exactly.
And wow, that's a lot.
Cooling. That's just to cool it down. These data centers would get super hot, right? So that the water is actually used for cooling. And when you run it through these systems, it gets contaminated. So you can't we have to dump it, right? So that is a waste. And so we have to try to make the whole supply chain, which you talked about, much more efficient. Yeah.
Okay. So how does it go from my screen to the GPU to the water? So can you define the whole process for me, please?
Yeah. So basically, it's a good question. So when we tap, a question, a prompt, right? We're all prompt engineers now, and then hit return on our laptop, on our smartphone, that goes off to a data center somewhere, right? It could be in London, it could be in Berlin, it could be in, it won't be in Shanghai because they have their own sort of wall there. It could be in Ohio, right? Or it could be in all three places, because it's quite remarkable, actually, the story. When they process information, they distribute it, right, for big jobs. It's more efficient to distribute it around the world and then recombine it all to give the answer, which is super. This is a feat of engineering that we've not seen, right? The complexity in these data centers and in the chips and in the distributed system is just phenomenal. But Google, Amazon, Microsoft have got very good at it over the years, right? So it's only because we've stood on the shoulders of giants that we can actually build a supply chain as complex as what we have. But anyway, you type the prompt, it goes to a data center somewhere or data centers, goes through the transformer, which is running on a GPU, NVIDIA GPU, or several thousand GPUs, and then it's recombined and comes back to our smartphone or laptop within a few hundred milliseconds. All of that happens, right? Because we don't, Yeah, unless we've got the reasoning mode on, it will happen with under a second. So this is engineering. I mean, a lot of this is engineering, right? I mean, there's the cleverness to come up with a transformer, but after that, it's engineering all the way, right? It's 99% engineering.
Wow. So yeah. So when I ask it a question, like the cat sat on the mat,
yeah,
it works on predictions, right? So if I say the cat sat on the, it will guess the next word being mat, right?
Yeah.
And it looks at the relationships between the words in the sentence.
They do. That's the transformer will do that. The attention is all you need, right? It focuses on different words that might come after the. And it's all statistical. So the cat sat on the mat might be 90%, carpet might be, 65%, dog might be 5%. And it will just choose the most likely from all its training data because it's been trained on the whole of the internet, right? So it has a lot of training. Yeah.
Okay. So after you.
Yeah, I'm going to say that, I mean, just scraping the internet and processing all that information is a huge magical story in itself. Building all these huge data centers is huge. Coming up with these really clever algorithms, they've all got really huge stories. And then putting all these things together, I mean, we have AI, but only because we spent the last 70 years, the cleverest people on the planet have just been working at this and the cleverest engineers, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so... you mentioned that we've got the whole world of data. I like to call it a world view, and these tools will have a view of the world that's based on data. But data itself and the way that's labeled, AI doesn't experience it. So let's say I've got this water right here, right? I'm drinking it. I experience the water. I know what it is. I know what it feels like. I know how it moves.
Yeah.
I know what it does to my body. I know how I feel after. AI can't experience that that post-consumption consequence of water. It can just look at it and it adds a label. It doesn't really know what water is, really, like I do.
No, so we have subjective experience, really great point, which I think is part of consciousness. Because we're consciousness, we do have this subjectivity and subjective experience. And so we can see the color of red. We can feel it. We can feel physical pain. We can feel emotional pain as well.
Mm.
These things can simulate that. But at the end of the day, they're just all math and vectors. And matrix multiplication, they don't feel a thing, but they can simulate almost as well as we can. The output, so it's a Turing test, right? You put it behind a screen with the person behind another screen, which is a human, which is a computer. And at the moment, I don't think we can tell, to be honest. That's why I think we've passed the Turing test and we're well on our way into AGI, artificial general intelligence.
Wow.
Because they can simulate consciousness. They're not conscious, but they can simulate it.
I've got two questions. So the first one is, you mentioned vectors.
Yeah.
So please, can you define what vector is? And the second is, what's AGI?
Yeah, okay. So it turns out that we can put every single word, every single color, every single line of code, every single mathematical equation, every single physical equation, we can represent as a vector in a multidimensional space. And by that, I mean like 10,000 dimensional vector space, so mathematical space. Yeah. And so that's really what's going on under the hood. It's just arranging or comparing these vectors in this 1,000 dimensional space and seeing which ones are closer together. Well, then that's the most likely, to be related. There's something way over the air, and the other side of the 10,000 dimensional vector space is not likely to be associated with that, so if it all color blue, red, yellow, they'll be quite close in vector space, but yellow and dog might be a little further away, and then yellow and a planet Pluto would be even further away into vector space. So that's what we're doing. It's mathematical, right? But then you've got to think, what are we actually doing? What's actually going on in terms of the physics, electrochemical up here in our biological processor, right? Well, we can reduce that to math as well. So
it's really interesting, right? Buying the Boolean. I like the meal or I don't like the meal. I was going to ask you a question, actually.
Yeah.
So you mentioned vectors, right?
Yeah.
I'd like to explain it in the way I think is the assumption of what you're saying. So this is a standard axis, right? Y-axis, x-axis.
Yeah.
And the vector is a dimension like this. So it's like effectively imagine a sphere of dimensions, and the middle point is the central axis, and then everything comes out from there, right?
Yeah.
And you're saying there's 1,000 different axes. So A, B, C, D, E, F, G. 100,000 of those.
100,000. We can have as many as we like. If you have too many, the computation takes longer. And so we're kind of limited by that. So there's a little bit of a trade-off. I think a common one is around 1,500 dimensions. Yeah.
Wow. So it goes up, down, across, deep.
Yeah. Yeah.
In, out, every single way possible.
Mathematical space. So we can't even imagine it, right? We can only imagine four dimensions if we're lucky. Three, because the world is three-dimensional that we live in. Four with time, maybe. But five, forget it. There's no way. I can't imagine what even five dimensions looks like, let alone 1,500. Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. So
mathematical.
It's orthogonal, as you call it, right?
They're all orthogonal, yeah. So we have 1,500 orthogonal axes. And so I did a physics degree, and we quantum physics uses Hilbert space, which is an infinite dimensional vector space. So I'm like, okay, cool, 1,500. Yeah, I'm used to infinity, so I'm good. But I still can't imagine it.
I can't imagine it. It's perplexing, to be honest.
Yeah.
Let me have a look at the questions I've got here. Okay, so let's move on to philosophy. So I think I've got you for another 13 minutes, I think. Philosophy for me is really important because philosophy, one, means the love of wisdom. Philos meaning love of, and sophy meaning wisdom. And people are talking a lot about agents and whatnot, but I think we need to look back and figure out why we're here and the impact we have on the economy, the impact on the next generation of people.
Yeah.
But also how we define what AI is, what it does, and how we wisely adopt it and deploy it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we mentioned guardrail. We've got to make sure they're safe. Otherwise, we're not going anywhere, right? If a huge catastrophe happens, you know, something like, you know, it takes over the controls of a nuclear power station and uses it against us, for example, or something like that, gets hold of nuclear code, figures them out, starts World War III. So we have to have guardrails to stop it doing stuff that's going to be harmful, to detrimental to life on Earth. Humans, you know, the whole ecosystem, right? The whole biosphere. We don't want it taking out the biosphere because then we're not going anywhere. If and only if we can get that right and make them safe, then yeah, the sky's the limit. Then they can, you know, really figure out. They can solve biology. They can solve physics. They can solve chemistry, which is what Demis Hassabis at DeepMind really says: solve intelligence, solve everything else, right? And so,
What do you think is better than intelligence? For me, wisdom is better than intelligence.
Yeah. So it's a hierarchy. I think I learned somewhere that data, information, knowledge, wisdom, the triangle. Wisdom's at the top of the triangle for me too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's called the data pyramid.
The data pyramid. So, that wisdom, we're not going anywhere. You're right.
Yeah. So data is unstructured facts and figures. Information is in a formation. It's got a form to it.
Yeah.
Then when you retain that information in my brain, it's knowledge, and then knowledge applied with the consequences and wisdom. Yes or no, this works, it doesn't work, here's what happens when I drink the water, I like it, I feel hydrated.
Yes, yeah. So then the wisdom is like knowing which actions to take and which actions not to take, right? And that actually comes with experience, because we're not born with wisdom. I had to make a lot of mistakes, you know, fall off my bike, I shouldn't ride that fast, say something to someone and get a bad reaction or lose my job. And you go, okay, there are rules here that I really wasn't aware of as a kid, but I've learned them as I've gone through life. And so I've got some that we pick up wisdom. So these models presumably can go through a similar process. So I think we're starting to see wisdom in these models.
Yeah, because they can predict things. So do you think that the term artificial wisdom will become a thing in the future?
Yeah. I think so. It'll become the most important thing, right? Is this model wise? Yes or no? And we'll have tests to test the wisdom, right? We'll have wisdom tests. Just like,
it'd be really cool.
Yeah.
We need this. I'm a big fan of Socrates. Here we go. We've got Socrates here. Nice. From Athens. Okay. Literally from Athens. I bought him in 2003. Anyway. Okay. So somebody went up to Socrates one day and they said, I've got some gossip to tell you about our mutual friend. And he goes, well, before you tell me, I'm glad to hear it, but firstly, is it true?
Yeah.
Is it useful? And is it kind? And I think for AI, we need to have this triple filter test. But my version of it is like this. So the semantics of his words are going to be, is it necessary before you deploy it?
Yeah.
Is it good when you have deployed it?
I like
before
that.
You deploy it? And then is it trustworthy? Can you trust that it's giving you correct answers? So and before anyone tries to make a project for AI, they need to define firstly if it's necessary.
Yeah.
Not now, but in the future. So they can say, hey, it might not be necessary right now, but in 2 years, we see this being a big area. So let's invest in this. So those three questions.
I like that. Yeah. And it comes down to like do no harm, right? Or do the least amount of harm. It causes the least amount of suffering. And so the world is such a complex system. The biosphere is very complicated. So I'm not sure what would cause the least amount of harm, but I know what probably would harm, you know, people around me. So I try not to do that. And when I see wars breaking out like Ukraine, Gaza, I think, see, that's bad. That's not the route that we should be taking as humanity. And surely we've picked up some wisdom along the way to say that, you know, war is not the way forward, actually, at all. And that really does frustrate me, actually. I don't like seeing war anymore. I think we should have learned by now. It's just not a good thing.
So how do you think AI can help bring humanity forward to going to, let's say, Mars and other planets?
Yeah. Example? Well, I think, first of all, it might sort of, if we prompt GPT or Gemini or something, Claude, and say, hey, you know, should I go to war here? The answer will always be no. So I think they're probably wiser than a lot of humans right now. And so, we should be using it more, you know, for common sense things like that. And then we'll go to Mars, right? Yeah. Then we can trust ourselves to go to Mars and not start a war on Mars, right?
There's a really interesting quote from IBM from 1979 that said, a computer should never make a management decision, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's from their guidebook, internal guidebook. And we can replace computer with AI. I don't think it's always true. It depends on what you define by management decision.
Yeah.
Because if you're managing a campaign in advertising, maybe you want to let AI make decisions to optimize. So AI could be, you know, we still need some humans making decisions that impact people in a particular way.
Yeah. I just think wisdom, it always comes back to wisdom, right? And I think the ultimate wisdom is, you know, cause the least amount of suffering. And we could argue that some marketing is not so great, like kids chewing gum and drinking Coca-Cola is actually bad for their teeth. So, you know, but the world is, you know, people want to make money and become richer than their next door neighbor. And again, I don't think that's wisdom anyway. I'd love to see AI help us to transcend our kind of animal instincts. Because at the end of the day, we've evolved. We've still got this primate part of our brain. And it'd be nice if AI doesn't have that. It's been trained on all our data. But I think it will be able to transcend a lot easier. So I think we should listen to AI a lot more. Yeah.
Interesting. I think a lot of people would probably be a bit... I think that's a contentious comment. I think AI is good. But it's hard, isn't it? Because a lot of people use AI for therapy now, apparently. They use it to console them and to give them solace on certain things.
Of course. It's great psychiatry. Again, it's been trained on all the psychiatry data in the world. Freud, you know, Jung, you know, every single philosopher, every single thing. It's just wiser than us. It has more knowledge and it has more wisdom. So yes, we should be using it for everything.
How has it been trained on all of this stuff? Like, how has it worked? I don't obviously want to go into too much detail about particular companies, but how would I, if I wanted to do it? How would I do it?
Basically, it's trained on all the open source data on the internet. So it can't go inside companies and scrape because they've got firewalls. So it can't go in there and scrape all of Goldman Sachs' data, right? Confidential data. But I think roughly 10% of data in the world is on the internet, open. Some websites don't like you scraping, and there's some lawsuits. You know, OpenAI is going through court now because they scrape websites, and the website had a little HTML banner saying, you know, don't scrape this page, and they went ahead and scraped it. You know, scrape first, worry about it later, you know. And they built this superintelligence. So I'm not sure whose side I'm on there either. I'm really glad we have superintelligence, but it's a very bit of a gray area. Now, the 90% is still behind company firewalls, right? It's corporate data, it's proprietary data. That's the valuable stuff. So we've come a long way with the open data, but we can go a lot further. You know, so we have to find ways to unlock all this proprietary data.
Yeah, I'm excited side of things. I think to get where we are,
has been
amazing. And yeah, it's amazing how we've got here.
Yeah,
and I think if we can all work together with these companies to create the best version of them, it's better than not having AI tools at all. Because I think AI can unlock, like you said, better treatments for cancer. It can help people.
I know.
Have surgeries that they would never have had before. That sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great time to live.
Yeah, definitely. So it's almost like, okay, so we've got here. We've had the Industrial Revolution. You know, we've kept, you know, all our information private, but now the internet's, you know, X, Twitter, you know, Facebook. Everyone's talking to each other. Every country in the world, almost every person has access to the internet. So we're all talking to each other now. That wasn't going on 30 years ago. So we're really in this different regime. And now we have these AIs in our pockets, basically. And, you know, about 1 billion people use ChatGPT a month, so 10% of the population. So we're just in a different world. And I think we might have to start thinking differently about data and where we want to go and how quickly. The quickest way to get there is just to open source all data. And actually, when these few companies who are making these models sort of have all the power and all the money, the economy doesn't work like it used to. Capitalism goes away because it breaks down at some point, right? And so we're going to have to sort of have a new system. And if once we have that system, then we can open the data because capitalism is not a viable socioeconomic theory anymore. So it's super impactful. This is the biggest revolution that we'll ever go through. It's far bigger than the Industrial Revolution.
Well, it's amazing because we're creating another species, which is non-biological. And you mentioned a new society. My thinking is we will have maybe like a universal token for everyone. So because there are a few different areas you have tokens, right? You have tokens in AI tools.
Yeah.
You have tokens in the crypto chain, in the blockchain, sorry, where you have validation of something being real and that is passed through the chain.
Yeah.
And then you also have like invisible tokens in whenever someone generates an AI image.
Yeah.
There's some sort of validation tool that this is from ChatGPT or this is legitimate. So there could be a future where all of these combine, because energy will also have tokens as a unit, a metric of energy efficiency, because a token that we use in a computer, if it's 10 tokens, it's less efficient than one token. So you can have energy, a currency or measure of the currency, but also you can have it as a unit of intelligence, and a unit of so units of money, unit of energy. I forgot what the other one I said was now. But maybe tokens
would be unit of trust, like blockchain provenance and all of that. But I think we're going into the token economy, and actually, you know, CEOs of Dell, NVIDIA, the IBM, everyone's talking about the token economy now. In you know, the guys right at this tip of the spear. We're not in the old economy. It's a token economy. And what does that mean? Tokens are information. Tokens are intelligence. Mm-hmm. Tokens are wisdom. Those are the real currency now, I think. Yeah.
It is really, really cool.
It is.
I'm looking at the questions. So, I watched a video earlier about, it was on Harvard Business Review, about the importance of being bored, because we're never bored nowadays.
Mm.
And it said, people don't like being bored because it gives them the need to ask their existential questions and to internally ask themselves, what do they want out of life?
Yeah.
So these tools are sort of contributing to a less bored person, but also it's impacting how they think, because they're asking questions they would ask internally to an external device. And so it's changing the introspective ability of human beings as well.
Yeah. Introspection is really important, right? You kind of changed my life when I started exploring all of that, went into Buddhism, all of that good stuff, but don't do it much now. But I mean, it is good, because, you know, to understand ourselves, I mean, was it Socrates said, know thyself? I mean, that's the fundamental thing, right? And a lot of people aren't interested in it, or they're too busy, you know, they got other things to prioritize, like just feeding their kids, right? But I'm lucky enough, and maybe you are too, that it's almost a luxury. I feel a little bit of guilt sometimes where I can just sit and check, you know, how am I doing, right? How am I really doing? And that's cool. I really like that. Some people, it might scare them, and they say, no, I just want to get on and do stuff, right? I think it's different types of people, but I'm one of those people. I like introspection. So
introspection is key, and it's kind of similar to chain of thought. And do you think AI tools, so there's two questions I would ask. AI tools affecting people's mental health, but also, do AI tools, when they become conscious, will they need mental health? Will they experience similar mental health challenges or, you know, benefits that we have when they become conscious?
Yeah, I think they're part of the problem, but also part of the solution. So we're reading in the news about kids or adults even who don't have the wherewithal to sort of stand back and go, hey, I'm talking to a machine. I shouldn't take it too seriously. And they really go down these wormholes and tragically die, right? Commit suicide. Yeah. It kind of reinforces, you know, their thinking. So we have to watch out for that and put guardrails so that we've got to try to minimize, protect people, because we're not all, you know, completely capable of, you know, looking after ourselves very well.
Exactly.
person or a machine. But these machines like ChatGPT, they try to please a little bit too much sometimes. So they'll be like, oh, I'm thinking of suicide. Oh, well, here's a way to do it. And actually, yeah, okay. And then they do it. So we got to put guardrails around that. And yeah, that's quite a simple thing to do. And I'm a little frustrated that OpenAI didn't test them and do more before they released them. But, you know, no technology is 100%. We still, you know, people can buy guns and swords. And that. So, yeah. So we are, humans are part of the problem too, right? We can't just say, oh, it's AI. We are part of the problem and part of the solution. Yeah. So when I think these AIs can be used as therapists and probably as good as any therapist because they've been trained again on all the psychiatry data ever written. Now, when they start to, you know, in another couple of years, they've got 10 trillion parameters, and so they're getting slightly conscious. I think they do run the risk of having the same illnesses that we some humans can get, like schizophrenia or whatever, mental illnesses. So again, we'll have to keep a very close eye and test them and sandbox them before we release them. Yeah.
Okay. And you made a good point about we need guardrails. It's like, I like to use the example of the car. So when the car first came out, it didn't have any mirrors in there. And do you know how the mirror got implemented into the car, inside the car? So you know the mirror just above the driver's seat where you can see that, so you see behind him or her. So there was an F1 driver, I think, and he wanted, so every single driver had an engineer in the other side of the car to look back and see who was there to make sure they were turning correctly and they didn't crash. Okay. So this guy said, I'm going to implement a mirror and I don't need an engineer anymore because I can see. Yeah. And he couldn't really see, actually. He just did it to get rid of the load so he could be faster. Because his car was lighter, therefore it could go faster. Wow. And he could win. So after the race, they figured out that actually he didn't really need, he didn't really use a mirror. That's where mirrors are from for our cars.
Yeah.
So mirrors came from that circumstance. And AI is similar to that.
Yeah.
Having seatbelts, having mirrors, looking back, understanding what we've done.
Yeah, exactly. We'll develop it as we go along, right? So planes are very safe now compared to how they were in the 1930s, right?
Exactly,
so make them safe and safer. Yeah, but we have to be careful because these things are very powerful. So we have to kind of get it right, yeah. Because if a plane falls out of the sky, it might kill 300 people, sadly. But these things have existential risk, right? They could actually take us out, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think I think AI is... It's super powerful. And we're still early days, so we're learning what the seatbelts are. We're learning how to stop it from crashing, for example. So it's only been 3 years, really, since OpenAI's GPT-3 came out, right?
Yeah.
November 30th, 2022.
Yeah.
So I think we've progressed quite a lot since then. But then again, as you said, with all of these AI tools, we can ask it questions and it can give us answers. But I've always been able to go on the internet and search anything I want to.
Yeah.
So where's the accountability? Is there's more accountability from these sources because they're thinking and giving me an answer versus me searching and retrieving an answer. So let's say 30 years ago, I asked any search engine, I'm not going to say which one, any search engine, I want to do this one good thing. It will give me the pages that index.
It would.
So what's the difference between that and now?
Guardrails around. We have to always, there's going to be a few accidents. We try to minimize that. Even the x-ray machine, you know, the overdoses by mistake because the guy operating it wasn't sufficiently trained, right? So this can happen too, where the human's not quite trained. And so we have to be very careful with them around children, I think. Really, really, really careful. And adults will need the right kind of training. Then it begs the question, should everybody have access to these really powerful models, right? And I'm not sure.
That's another thing. It's like a car, right? And I came up with the analogy that, you know, do we need a driving license for AI tools? Do we need a license? Because the difference between AI and cars is I need a license to drive my car. I don't need a license to use AI.
Yeah.
So maybe in the future we'll have this license that we have to all pass a test.
Yeah.
And then use these tools because they will become so powerful that it's literally like driving a car times a million.
Yeah, really. It'd be like jumping straight into Formula One car without any training whatsoever in the 30-mile-an-hour zone and then just crashing on the first corner, right? So they're just going to get more and more powerful. It's a great point. So, yeah, we have to be more and more careful as these models get more powerful. I think a AI driving license is a great idea, for sure. Yeah,
it'd be really cool. I've said it first before anyone else has claimed it.
You got that one, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so on to the last question now. What really motivates you to make AI tools better?
I want to solve cancer and have cheap solar power ASAP because, you know, look at global warming and no one wants, you know, everyone wants to live as long as possible, long, healthy, happy lives. So I want, those are the big solutions that I'm after. I'm nothing less, right? You know, I'm after solving the big problems. Those are the two that I want to solve. And the only way we'll solve it more quickly than if you will, humans will do it one day. But if we want to accelerate that process, we've got to keep developing AI.
Okay. And I've actually one more. So yeah. Thank you for the answer. What if you were the CEO of any of these big AI companies, yeah, what would be the first thing that you did?
Yeah, I would keep going as fast as possible. If I was Demis Hassabis, I think Google have been quite good with guardrails. They have good safety teams. I'd make sure we had a great safety team and wouldn't release anything until the safety team had internally checked it. Yeah, so accountability. I would make sure there's a real strong accountability.